Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. The United Nations chief warns of genocide in South Sudan if actions are not taken immediately.
As efforts to revive the political process continue, the least we can do is to stop the flow of more weapons which pose a direct threat to the safety and security of civilians and humanitarian workers.
And an oil cooperation deal is extended between Sudan and South Sudan.
We are having difficulties internally and also globally because the oil price fell. So that's why we came to our brothers and sisters in Sudan to rearrange this TFA.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned in New York yesterday that South Sudan could be on the verge of genocide unless immediate action is taken. Ban reiterated his plea to the 15-member UN Security Council to approve an arms embargo on the country, saying, "If we fail to act, South Sudan will be on a trajectory towards mass atrocities."
We have repeatedly seen the deliberate targeting of civilian communities perceived to support an opposing side. As efforts to revive the political process continue, the least we can do is to stop the flow of more weapons which pose a direct threat to the safety and security of civilians and humanitarian workers.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Samantha Power, who for weeks has also been urging the Security Council to vote on an arms embargo and targeted sanctions, said South Sudan's obstruction of assistance, including the recent deportation of four aid workers, indicates the situation is only getting worse. She noted that the SPLM in opposition is also making it difficult for aid workers to help the needy. Power says a resolution imposing an arms embargo and sanctions could tamp down the violence.
The people within the UN system whose job it is to sound the alarm have sounded it. History is going to show what each of us did, where each of us stood, when the sirens were blaring, when the red lights were flashing in South Sudan. That's where each of us have to be counted. Where were we when the lights flashed red for the people of South Sudan?
Power warns that the UN's wait-and-see posture could stall any progress in preventing atrocities.
We need to bring this resolution at last to a vote, which we will do by the end of this year. Members of the Council will need to raise their hands and make a decision on where they stand on the issues of life and death that have been raised by the Secretary General, that have been raised by everyone who goes to South Sudan and comes back, and above all, that the people of South Sudan have at stake.
Ban, whose term comes to an end on the last day of the year, says new reports suggest that President Salva Kiir and his loyalists are contemplating a new military offensive in the coming days against opposition troops allied with former First Vice President Riek Machar, who fled the country shortly after the flare-up in fighting in July. South Sudan's government says any arms embargo would significantly reduce the country's ability to be a sovereign nation. A Tenwek Aten spokesman for President Kiir tells VOA's James Buddy that imposing an arms embargo on his country would be very unfortunate for the United States, which played a key role in South Sudan's independence.
It will be extremely unfortunate for a country like United States of America, who helped to midwife South Sudan, to also try desperately to kill the same child it has helped some 5 years ago to come to being, now wanted to make sure that it destroyed South Sudan. Because arms embargo will significantly reduce the ability of South Sudan to be a sovereign country, because it will make South Sudan weak and susceptible to an outside invasion.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, has said that the situation in your country is not getting better. In addition, your government and perhaps the Riek Machar rebels, you are getting ready for more war.
No, well, this is not true. With my respect to the United States ambassador to United Nations, the information she's actually talking about is not correct, because she might have got information from those who wanted to see South Sudan, you know, becoming weaker and weaker, those who have hidden agenda. Otherwise, there's no preparation for war, because the government of South Sudan is fighting nobody. The main rebel group that the South Sudan government was fighting since 2013 signed peace agreement, and they are now fully implementing peace agreement under the leadership of President Salva Kiir Mayardit and General Taban Dengai. And therefore, the fear of more fighting in South Sudan, or what they call looming genocide, are just utopian. And these are just the making of those who wanted to raise funds and try to seek job in South Sudan.
According to the draft resolution which Ambassador Powell is pushing, there is a part of it that will impose sanctions on your Minister of Information, Michael Makui, and a rebel general. This is a serious matter now.
No, this is, you know, to tell you very clear, they are just victimizing the Minister of Information, and they are even victimizing those individual chosen to be a target, you know, of sanction. These people, including Minister of Information, they are like any other Minister of Information in the world, you know, trying to do their legitimate part of collective responsibility. And not more than that, they are not fueling war. They are just defending the legitimacy of the government, and therefore targeting them is targeting South Sudan, because they have not done anything that would actually be seen to be fueling war. The opposite is true. These people are the ones who want South Sudan to survive.
So you don't believe that South Sudan is headed towards a possible genocide, because the purpose of the arms embargo, according to Ambassador Powell, is to reduce the possibility of a genocide in your country?
I don't think that the intelligence of Ambassador's Samantha Power has reduced not to to realize that genocides are not committed by using firearms. The Rwandan genocide in 1994 did not use a single shot, but yet they killed nearly 1 million using machetes, you know, knives and spears, you know, and then South Sudan has a significant number of those weapons that can affect if genocide is needed. But I don't think there is anybody who needs genocide, because we are brothers and sisters. We have lived far enough before any foreigner coming to our country.
That's President Kiir's spokesman, Atenuak Aten, speaking with VOA's James Buddy earlier today from Juba. Sudan and South Sudan extended for another 3 years their oil cooperation agreement today in Khartoum. The deal also covers security and financial arrangements between the two nations, as we hear from Nabil Biagio for VOA in the Sudanese capital.
South Sudan Minister of Petroleum and Mining Isaac Lol Gatkwat says he wrapped up talks with his Sudanese counterparts today on the 2012 deal covering trade, movement and security for the next 3 years.
And in the 3 years, we will also restructure the transitional financial arrangement, restructure it how we can pay back our sisterly country.
The transitional financial arrangement, or TFA, was reached between the two countries when South Sudan seceded from Sudan, taking with it 75% of the oil revenues that Sudan previously enjoyed when the two countries were one. South Sudan was to pay Sudan about $3.3 billion from Juba oil revenues over 3.5 years. Gatkwat says the agreement needed to be renegotiated because oil production and prices have fallen dramatically over the past couple of years.
We are having difficulties internally and also globally because the oil price fell. So that's why we came to our brothers and sisters in Sudan to rearrange this TFA. And that is what we have agreed. If the price of the barrel is 20 to 30, we will pay these percentages. If it is this and this, we will pay this.
Gatkwat says Sudan and South Sudan agreed to work together to provide more support to revive the oil industry in South Sudan so that the two countries can fulfill the terms of the cooperation agreement.
We also had signed an MOU between the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan in how we can cooperate in all areas, starting with us getting power from Michilichu so that we can start the production in Unity Oil Field. Also us using the base camp in Michilichu so that our oil workers can work there. also the training and the capacity building in all areas. Sudan, the Ministry of Petroleum agreed to really facilitate our staff to be trained and their capacity to be built.
Speaking in Arabic, Sudan's Minister of Petroleum, Mohammed Zayed Awad, says his ministry will cooperate fully with his South Sudanese counterpart.
There will be good cooperation between Sudan and South Sudan in providing logistical and technical support after we make sure that security arrangements are in place to protect the oil fields and the workers from both sides.
Awad says Sudan will also help South Sudan rehabilitate oil sites that have been affected by the 3 years of fighting in South Sudan in a bid to increase oil production.
We signed a memorandum of understanding to restart these dormant oil fields and that have been out of order for some time now. We will also provide training and make our research facilities available to that end.
The two parties also agreed that refined oil products treated in Sudanese refineries, such as gasoline, will be provided to South Sudan at a discounted price. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi is praising the safe release yesterday of three UNHCR staff members abducted on November 27th in El Ganina, Sudan. The freed staff workers are Vasroon Pradhan, Ramesh Karki, and Musa Omer Musa Mohammed. Grandi thanked the Sudanese government and the UN's hostage management team, who he said worked tirelessly for their release. He says UNHCR staff are doing everything possible to ensure they are being well taken care of. Grandi urged all parties, not just in Sudan but everywhere, to respect international humanitarian law and ensure the protection of all civilians, including aid workers who helped refugees affected by conflict and persecution. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Health facilities at a large refugee settlement in Uganda are pushed to the breaking point. We'll have more on that story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you are asked to help the poor, what do you do?
Although I don't have much, but I will try my best to help them either in kind or if I have a little cash, I will share it with them.
You look at what they do best, you try to empower them on that. And then a person who is an illiterate, you try to help him. If there is a way you can help him go to school, you do that.
Well, our target street children, the poor in the street, because they are vulnerable. They are the next generation. If we lose them to poverty, we will not have that generation.
It depends on the type of help I want. If I have what they need, I will give them. And if I don't have, I will tell them I really don't have place. Yeah, but I will be really happy to help the poor.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we're talking about health facilities at a Ugandan refugee settlement. Bidibidi settlement camp officials in Uganda's Yumbe district say large numbers of South Sudanese refugees continue pouring in each day and have overwhelmed health facilities. Officials say the large number of refugees has put a strain on all available medical services. Simon Peter Apiku visited Bidibidi camp recently and has this report for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Dr. Alex Paul Tezita heads a team of doctors and medical staff from the American non-governmental organization Real Medicine Foundation, or RMF, which manages the settlement's health centers. Tezita says the Bidibidi Health Center, located in one of the settlement's five zones, was originally intended to serve some 20,000 refugees. Tezita says the center now provides medical services to nearly 60,000 refugees, most of whom are from South Sudan.
And for Zone 1, where we are in this locality, we have 53,000 refugees, only refugees. Now, plus the number of nationals.
The Bidi Bidi Health Center was the first health facility established in Dakam. The structures are all temporary, constructed from timber and plastic sheeting. The center has outpatient and inpatient departments as well as a maternity ward. Tezita says for cases that require surgery, he refers patients to other facilities outside the settlement.
We don't have theater, so we cannot operate patients here. We have emergency cases of obstetrics, maternity related. Those are obstetric cases for which require operation. So we don't have a theater, though we have the human resource to do that. We have the doctors, but we don't have the facilities.
And he says there are not enough ambulances in the settlement. Up until recently, each of the settlement's five zones had just one ambulance.
We have five zones, and each zone has a minimum of 50,000 refugees, minimum. Like zone one has 56, and one ambulance here. It's not enough for that zone. For example, if there is a mother here who requires to be taken for referral for a Caesar, safe to Yumbe, and there is another emergency in the same zone, now the other ambulance has gone. How about the other patient?
The number of people seeking medical services at the Bidi Bidi Health Center has also been growing steadily over the past months. Only two doctors and a handful of clinical officers and nurses work at the center. Tezita says his staff is simply overwhelmed.
On a daily basis, the outpatient department consultation is around 320. On daily basis, and the inpatient on ward on daily basis is around 55 to sometimes 65.
He says patients have to wait long hours before seeing one of the two doctors running the facility. Juma Avere is a resident of the Bidi Bidi settlement zone 1. Speaking in the local Madi language, he says patients spend nearly the entire day waiting to see a doctor.
Our major problem here is getting treatment. You go to the health center in the morning and spend the whole day there. Sometime you return at 4 in the afternoon.
Aunt Avery says many patients are not given all the prescribed drugs they need to cure a disease.
The medicines they give us are not enough. The doctor prescribes the correct dosage, but the people giving the drugs reduce the dosage. Sometimes you get 6 tablets, which you take every 8 hours for 24 hours, and it is over before the disease is cured.
Ibura James came to the health center with her 2-year-old son complaining of acute headaches. Speaking in Arabic, James says she first sought help at a similar facility near her home, but after taking the full dose of the prescribed drugs, her headache persisted.
They gave me some tablets. I took the tablets and completed the prescribed dosage, but my condition did not improve. That is why I decided to come to this place.
Anthony Lujang, another South Sudanese refugee who fled his native Lanya village 3 months ago, says he came to the health center hoping to get help for his fractured bone. A motorcycle hit him while he was visiting relatives in the neighboring town of Kawako. He says he had to pay for treatment at a hospital in the town, but his bones did not heal properly. Lujang says he decided to seek treatment at the refugee facility because he had run out of money to pay for treatment at the Kaboko hospital.
They have taken all of my money, so now I don't have money. That is why I come back also here to this hospital to be treated freely.
Aside from the main Bidi Bidi Health Center, the settlement now has two other facilities that have outpatient departments. Tezita says following a recent recruitment for additional staff, his center now has a total of 4 doctors, 6 clinical officers, and a few more nurses. Officials have also trained dozens of community health workers who carry out health promotion activities in the camp, such as reminding pregnant women about the need to visit antenatal clinics, vaccinations for children, and educating refugees about the importance of good hygiene and nutritional habits. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Apiku in Yumbe District, Uganda.
The head of South Sudan's Chamber of Commerce says illegal roadblocks along the Juba-Nimule Road is hurting traders and consumers. Simon Akwe-Deng, Secretary General of the South Sudan Chamber of Commerce and Industry, says although the government removed illegal roadblocks on most roads, security forces have erected new ones, including some in the capital, Juba. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Simon Akwe-Deng says during the July fighting in Juba, many shops were looted. As a result, demand for food items remain high in the capital, as many traders are afraid to travel in secure roads like the Juba-Nimule Road and are tired of paying illegal taxes to security forces erecting their own roadblocks along the way.
We don't call them official. The other 18 that range from 50 pounds to 5,000 pounds. They are not official. And therefore, it is also a contributing factor as to why. It's not just inflation only, but these roadblocks of different kind, up to 20 items, are the contributing factor to the prices in the market, among other factors.
Deng says officials in his office plan to meet with the other government officials to come up with ways to help traders safely import enough food to Juba. In the border town of Nimule, custom officials who part of the Ministry of Interior tax traders on imported goods. Deng says if traders have to pay illegal taxes on top of government taxes along the roads, prices will continue to shoot up in the markets because traders will try to recover those costs in the prices they charge. He says Juba residents are tired of paying high prices for everything.
It harms our mothers, it harms our sisters, it harms our parents. It harms everybody. A single person act harms so many people. So we are telling them to stop doing this illegal thing.
Deng says the Chamber of Commerce is coordinating with the Ministry of Interior to remove illegal roadblocks along the Juba-Nimule Road.
We are appealing to our government, the Ministry of Interior, to start taking care of these people. They have to be, if they are collecting money, and the government has to arrest them. The government has to make sure that they don't exist so that we do business in a free environment.
South Sudan's inflation rate started climbing in late 2013 after fighting erupted in the capital, Juba. South Sudan's inflation rate now stands at 836%, according to the Commodity Price Index. The U.S. dollar, which traders use to import goods into the country, has shot up from 18 South Sudanese pounds to a dollar to 90 South Sudanese pounds to a dollar. Last week, traders in Juba told the VOA that they will shut down their businesses because customers say they can no longer afford the steep price hikes in the market. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Receiving credible sources of information is a challenge in South Sudan. Communication experts say during conflict, parties often try to change the narrative to advance their own objectives. Professor Matthew Lariche of Memorial University in Canada, Goithon Leek, a South Sudanese native in Nairobi, and Gatano Dumo, a civil society activist in Canada, speak to John Tanza about what fuels hate speech in social media.
Dr. Matthew, this brings into the question of credible sources. Like you say, the media is not only limited to Facebook. Now, are there any credible sources outside here in the diaspora that people might take it as gospel truth and believe in it, and they start acting on some of the rumors that might be on the media?
Yeah, well, so you know, most of us, journalists, others, you know, who are involved in trying to, and in most average people, you know, you want to have a couple or three usually or more even points of information in terms of, you know, whether you're going to verify what you're hearing or not. And so we have people who are in the diaspora or outside or other commentators who hold credibility because they're in many cases seen as, and they're coming from a community, they're educated, and there is a credibility that comes with your ability to function on that social media space. So then on top of that, what happens very much is because of the nature of the way social media functions, you know, you get a group of people who are effectively repeating the same language, the same idea back and forth amongst each other, because social media feeds that back to you, because the way the systems are organized is they're trying to feed and find what you would be interested in, for example, right? So social media systems don't go out and find, they don't say, okay, this comment or these stories that this person's reading, let's go find something different to challenge that with. In fact, what it goes and finds similar stories, it finds similar narratives. So then when it's communicated back to a community in South Sudan, and this doesn't take very long to happen because of how quick the internet works.
Goy, what are your points of information? Professor Matthew is raising a very important point here.
Okay, I personally I searched two different websites. There are a variety of websites, Sudan Tribune, Wikipedia, and so on. There are a lot of them, SBS. And again, I do not limit myself to that information that I get from these sources. I call people on the ground in Juba and ask what is happening and try to verify. I try to talk to the people around me and see the credibility of the information that I'm generating from the internet. I do not rely on the internet. I have to get the information that I get filtered before I communicate it.
And Gaetano, here in North America, I've witnessed a situation where when one person sends a message, it quickly spread all over, and you see people start debating on it, and whether it is true or false, people are just talking about it. What are some of your points of information?
Well, I normally go to social media, but the authenticity of all the reports on social media, for me, I take it like 20% accurate. So the way I do it, I have people in South Sudan, I have people in Juba, I have people who are working in the government, I have friends and families that I normally consult. And, you know, I call them on a regular basis to get at least something of, you know, accurate information. And again, indeed, like even contacting people down in South Sudan, all this information may not yet be accurate because people tend to diverge information based on their political affiliation. It's not always very easy to get accurate information. So the way I go about all this is to give it a time. If something comes up, just give it a few days, and then we will be able to verify the authenticity of the reports.
That's Professor Matthew Larici of Memorial University in Canada, Goithon Leek, part of the South Sudanese diaspora in Nairobi, and Gaetano Dumo, a civil society activist in Canada. They were sharing their views about how social media can fuel hate speech. Tomorrow, we will hear about the role of South Sudanese parents in hate speech.
Yeah.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Reconciliation by Kabas. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. We're glad you could be here today. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Lakini omi na yam shitan da kalfi ras vitam kada kukuwad lahadi lupari has no bad to call a friend.
Forgiveness wanna preach.
team. I have a strong desire burning like a fire. Let us take time, making we can take it higher. This the generation to change the nation through peace and
reconciliation. Umon bikeli manina masaki, lakini na mistakal sedi. Umon bikeli manina deifi, lakini na inu iman. Reconciliation, yaudi na deru. Manina.